The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication, with features written by the readers for the readers. It contains both academic articles and light, fun reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. If you're a fan of The Great Detective, The Good Doctor, and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to know more about the journal, how to subscribe, or how to offer your own services at writing an article, their website is www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
Dr. Ainstree is an expert in coolie diseases from Sumatra, which implies he may be of Dutch parentage. Horribly contagious contagions, Tampanuli fever, and Blatformosa corruption. To date, no one save Dr. Ainstree knows what a corruption is, medically speaking. We are grateful for his sponsorship and wish him luck in wiping the floor with Sir Jasper Meek and Penrose Fisher. Wessex Press, an imprint of Gasogene Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers. The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation on Sherlock Holmes, is a collection of essays written by online fans. It was edited by several of the Baker Street Babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street Babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1
All right, this is Baker Street Babes, live and local. This is BSB Ashley, and I'm here at the University of West London with Professor Jeremy Strong. Now tell me if I get this right. BA Honours, MA, PhD, FRSA, FHEA, JP?
Correct.
Easily the most post-nominal guest we've ever had, so there's that. So if everything else goes tits up, at least you've got the qualification
that
right from the beginning. And we're here to talk about Jeremy's novel that was published in 2013, Mean Business. And it's an adventure novel set in the 19th century, told by a first-person narrator, officer serving in Her Majesty's Army in the East, shot, returned home to London, teams up with a strong-willed, rather eccentric fellow who draws our young hero into the seedy underworld of London crime and intrigue. But not a Sherlock Holmes novel, so that'll surprise our readers. Would you tell us a little bit about, give us a little summary?
Well, I guess you started with not a Sherlock Holmes novel. Yeah, that's true. It's not a Sherlock Holmes novel, but Sherlock Holmes stories were, I guess, amongst the things that were circulating in my mind as I wrote it. Those would be one of a bunch of influences, which would span Patrick O'Brien, the Sharp novels, Flashman. But Sherlock Holmes, I guess the thing that I like most about Sherlock Holmes was always, you know, what Doyle does with that narrating voice of Watson, where you've got the world's cleverest guy, but he's basically narrated by amongst the world's most impercipient people. And I think there's loads of comedy in that. So I think, you know, those scenes where Watson is telling you that he's just encountered some smelly secondhand bookseller or whatever, and you as a reader are kind of clapping your forehead and saying, oh, for God's sake, it's Holmes, man. You know it's Holmes. You must know it's Holmes by now. But he doesn't. I really like that kind of playing with levels of knowledge. So I was mindful that I wanted my narrator to do that because, I mean, I didn't want to make him a complete dork, but I wanted to make him unworldly in some respects, and to set him against another, you know, a principal protagonist, Valentine Fanshawe, who's kind of the world's coolest guy. You know, he's not quite, but he's sort of almost a version of James Bond, maybe just, you know, a bit more amoral, immoral. So, yeah, I mean, Holmes was clearly Holmes was there when I was thinking about how these characters would work, and more particularly how I'd look to narrate them.
It's sort of an interesting idea that, I mean, Bond and Holmes are quite similar in a lot of ways, but they're quite different in some ways. Particularly the kind of womanizing aspect of them is very different. And to kind of reimagine what a Watson character would look like if his Holmes was James Bond instead of Holmes is interesting. And perhaps that's where we get, you've got a whole nother layer in there of Yeoman, who's our narrator. We've got his sexual innocence as well, which
yes.
is really amusing all the way through, in the same way that you're sort of clapping your forehead with Watson, not
yeah.
knowing that you know, it's Holmes in disguise. Every time Yeoman is with a woman, you're just hysterically laughing inside, because he's narrating his experiences from complete innocence.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm always glad to hear that anybody was laughing through the bits that I wanted people to think were funny. I certainly... probably right at the outset, I hadn't decided, you know, that what he needs to be is a 30-year-old virgin. But actually, I realised it was much funnier that he was. I mean, of course, set against any kind of historical verisimilitude, the idea that somebody's, you know, been and done military service in India in the mid-19th century as a single man and has come back, you know, has come back a virgin, you know, from the land of the Kama Sutra was wildly unlikely. But, you know, I like this idea that, you know, I would make him a vicar's son, and that he has these, you know, he's unworldly, but he's particularly unworldly in respect of women. So, you know, yeah, he's been a soldier, he's fought, he's killed people. So he knows the world in that sense, but in another sense, kind of sexually, yes, he's a complete innocent. And he's also kind of blind to some of the badness of the world, to some of its badness and its dishonesty, mm-hmm. etc. And that, so I was trying to do that sort of fish out of water thing where you take somebody who is least like the environment into which they're going to be precipitated, and then you willfully precipitate them into it and see how it goes. So that kind of, you know, the Bond or Holmes thing, yes, you have that sort of total difference in that, you know, Bond is kind of guided by the sort of the twin stars of Her Majesty's service, you know, and, you know, wherever his sexual impulses take him. And, you know, amazingly, that coincides an awful amount of the time. And then you've got Holmes, who has this kind of curious lack of interest. And I felt that, you know, I didn't want to play either of those cards, but I thought by having the character of Valentine Fanshawe as, you know, this kind of enormously sort of sexually experienced guy who's, you know, really been around the world, frequenter of brothels, knows every, you know, good-looking woman around, etc., and then to have him as the guide to someone who's an innocent. I quite like that idea.
Yeah, so poor Yeoman, you dump him into a world of gambling dens and brothels, which is not his milieu.
No, it's not. I mean, at one stage, I literally found myself on the back of an envelope thinking, oh, right, where should I take this guy? I'm sure that's a really amateur version of plotting, but I found myself doing that where I did, you know, I did brothel was like top of the list. I you know, had to be a brothel, and I thought, well, you know, why not an opium den? And I suppose certainly when I thought of the opium den, I guess it was Holmes that I had in mind. I mean, that's a later version. You know, you're later into the 19th century there by several decades.
Yes.
But there had been Chinese immigrants in London, and I felt that I wasn't completely swinging the lead in terms of its plausibility. But yeah, it's fair to say I would certainly hesitate to describe it as a historical novel. You know, I mean, historical implies a kind of duty to regard for historical accuracy, which. Yeah, I mean, I haven't got any of my guys wearing a Rolex, but I'm pretty happy to let them do things that sit a bit outside time, as well as trying to have some things in there that really key it to a particular space.
Right. Well, Conan Doyle is notoriously horrible at consistency, not only with historical consistency and keeping years straight, but internal consistency. So at least Yeoman remembers where he was shot all the way through the novel, which is not true of Watson. He, through the stories, of course, he was Maybe he was shot in the shoulder, maybe in the leg. He can't remember because Conan Doyle didn't care about going back and looking up what he'd written before. So you've got that going for you.
But I guess I'm only one novel in, and I can see how it would be a real challenge to manage that thing of, you know, who, what, who gets shot, where, when, etc. And, you know, not to bring people back from the dead. But of course, you know, hell, if we're talking about bringing people back from the dead, Holmes really is the super case.
Right. And remembering your characters' names, there's famously Watson's wife calls him James. His name has been John all the way through. And that's nobody's really sure why. Did Conan Doyle forget? Was it a pet name? We don't know. You can always just explain it away.
Yes.
The good news is maybe a cult will grow around your books.
Well, I can only dream.
Filling in the inconsistencies.
All I would say, if it is, it's a pretty small cult so far.
So let's back up just a little bit more into the process. So we've got this pair, this team of Yeoman and Fanshawe. And you've set them particularly in the year is 1858.
Yeah.
So Yeoman was with the Indian Mutiny. Is that where he was serving?
Yes. I wanted to try and find a way of having someone who's come out of a really formative life event and things are going to change. So he's been involved, as a serving officer in the Indian Mutiny. I knew that I wanted him to have been in one of the East India Company regiments rather than in the regular army. Mm-hmm. So opportunities for advancement, yes, very similar to the British Army, yes, but socially not quite the thing.
Mm.
Because he's coming from a background which is, you know, it's certainly not aristocratic. It's, you know, the kind of lower levels of the gentry. Father's a vicar, could easily be precipitated down the social scale. And so he's gone to India and he hasn't made a hash of it, but probably because he doesn't have an eye out for the main chance financially, he's not been promoted incredibly rapidly either. So he's sustained this injury, come back to the UK to recuperate, and then we have this sort of formative moment at the beginning of the book where it appears that he's not going to be back into his regiment and, you know, why can't he, etc. He's not that badly injured. But actually, it's because this opportunity has been offered to him to do effectively undercover work for this chap, Valentine Fanshawe, whom he doesn't know and with whom he has absolutely nothing in common.
So why the Victorian period? Why the 19th century? What's your interest that led you to decide to set a novel there? Did that precede the story or did you sort of start thinking of characters and went, no, this is where they'll
thrive. Suppose I started thinking of characters. I knew that I wanted to write about adventure and I knew I wanted it to be in the past. I liked the idea of writing about things like that kind of borderline between just crime and espionage. And I didn't want to be writing about it in terms of the endlessly written about kind of contemporary arrangements for those things, or the sort of end of the First World War through to the present day. I mean, I think there are loads and loads of books about assassins and spies, etc. You know, the sort of Jason Bourne type characters,
sure,
and the stuff written by Chris Ryan. And I didn't really want to get into long technical discussions about the best type of sniper rifle. Though actually, that is a conversation I'm perfectly happy to have. But I didn't think that was really what would thrill the kind of readers that I wanted to reach. And so, yeah, I guess I fastened on that period partly because I felt that I didn't want to be writing about the kind of Napoleonic Wars, because I felt they'd been written about, you know, three writers whom I really like. Patrick O'Brien, Alan Mallinson, and Bernard Cornwell have all done big series, you know, variously, you know, infantrymen, cavalrymen, you know, and at sea of that time. And I kind of plumped for something in the middle. And I guess it also allowed me to do the kind of London that I wanted to write, because London's kind of a character in a way in the novel, and I felt that Victorian period, just as you approach the death of Albert, is, you know, it's really, really Victorian, if that makes any sense, and that you can do that, you know, and no ludicrous comparisons here, but you can do that kind of Dickensian sweep of the worst of society through to the top.
Yes.
And the kind of the connections between, which I kind of consciously wanted to do.
Absolutely. So London is a character, and I suppose the things that I read that I like the most are Victorian London, obviously, for obvious reasons. But London as a character seems to be a theme throughout, that it just has its own vibrant life. And did you spend much time sort of researching that, or did you let your history lessons in school inform you, or were you just
I guess, like a lot of things, it's mostly informed by my reading. Mm. So, I mean, that's informed in part by reading of fiction, so literally Victorian fiction, as well as fiction set in that period but written subsequently. And I tried to use other sources, I mean, particularly for trying to paint a picture of some of the scenes. Like, I have a description of Covent Garden Market. Now, that, if you know Mayhew, you know, London Labour and Poor, then you'd be able to find where I've lifted some of those names and some of those ideas from, simply because the guy did this enormously exhaustive and very, very interesting study of the trades and people of the streets, etc. So a range of sources, Wikipedia occasionally, yes, I'm going to have to admit to that.
You don't let your students use Wikipedia?
No, I don't, but then I'm not submitting it for assessment, other than to the rigours of the reading public. But it can be a useful source for looking up something the first time,
sure,
and then going to look further on. But I guess that's why, in terms of what I would ironically call my credentials, you know, I'm you know, really not positioning myself in any way as kind of a Victorian specialist or this as a historical novel. I'm kind of intoxicated by that idea of a certain kind of London. So, yeah, it's historically located, but loosely, let's say.
It's sort of marvelously, almost fictionally located, or literarily located rather than historically located. You have all these points of contact between different sort of fictional worlds. On page one, you find that Yeoman has been wounded in Chandrapur,
yes,
which is a fictional place from
Passage to India.
Right, Passage to India. So you have points of contact there. I don't want to give away any spoilers, but we sort of have a almost feels like a Bondian MI6 origin story with Q, which I was sitting in a cafe, and when that turned up, I laughed out loud. And I know this is on radio, so people perhaps need it spelled out, but Q in the Bond novels is the letter Q.
Yes.
And you have a Q as in Kew Gardens.
Absolutely. K-E-W. Well, I mean, there is I can live with spoiling that. That's not a major plot point. That one, actually, I have to be honest, came to me on a plate. I was writing this in what I very ironically call my free time, and at the time I was working at an agricultural college where I had a management post. And one of my colleagues was telling me a story of how, a colleague we both worked with had been speaking to our finance department about some invoice to do with Kew Gardens, which obviously still exists. Mm-hmm. And I think they'd taken a group of students there, and we owed them money, or they owed us a refund or something. And they'd been having this conversation down the phone with somebody in finance, and they were saying, well, who's it for? whichever frustrated lecturer it was said, Q, you know, it's Q, for God's sake, Q. And duly, of course, they then got this finance back to them, which just had the letter Q at the top. So I thought, hey, do you know what? I'm going to use that, because at the time I did have in mind that I liked this idea of our two protagonists going to basically be, you know, outfitted for an adventure. Mm-hmm. And I liked the idea of sort of playing on the one hand of London's trades, and, you know, the idea that, yes, you know, London historically there have been, you know, tailors, outfitters, gunsmiths, safari outfitters, sure, etc. And I loved the idea from the Bond stories that particularly the Bond movies latterly, that, you know, he gets all these wonderful toys to play with, and you always have this, you know, these kind of repeated lines like, "Oh, this is in the experimental stage," or whatever. And he then goes on to use all these,
because he always gets precisely the ones that will turn up in that adventure.
Yeah, exactly. So I really like that, and I just wanted to try and find a way of tying them in. And I had been to a couple of times. I visited the premises of Holland and Holland, the real life gun makers in London, and I thought, yeah, I could just imagine a version of kind of walking into that shop, which is like something out of time, and then, yes, you know, some secret door taking you somewhere where there's even more amazing stuff,
right,
for servants of the crown.
Yes, so those wonderful moments. Fanshawe certainly reminds me of Flashman in a lot of ways, though he is rather a lot more competent than Flashman, but he has so. Perhaps the moral.
I think his moral compass is also set due south. I mean, I adore the Flashman novels, and I think they're probably not as popular as they once were, and I guess in part that owes to George MacDonald Fraser's political positioning. But I think if you read those novels, what they're not is a kind of uncritical celebration of empire and militarism and all the things, the awful things that Britain did to other countries and other peoples around the world. I mean, actually, what you come across is a lot of candid accounts of, you know, incompetence, brutality, etc. And then the idea that you have this anti-hero in Flashman who manages to range across history, you know, variously having sex left, right and centre, and ducking bullets and always managing to appear as a hero.
Right.
I find... okay, in some of the later novels, it's, you know, how many times can you pull this thing off? But you know, I've read them all and enjoyed them all enormously. And so, yeah, I guess Flashman was in my mind when I was thinking of the character of Fanshawe, but I guess more like the kind of the public image of Flashman as, you know, as brave. And yet I wanted to play with that by having someone who, as far as society knows... he is formerly a soldier of high rank, a colonel, but there's been some kind of unspecified disgrace around his private life, and he has retreated to a certain extent. He's certainly not openly serving as a military officer, but actually what he's done is, you know, he's now got the biggest job he's ever had.
Right.
He just can't talk about it. But yeah, and at the same time, he is... you know, he's violent, he's dangerous, he's a kind of sexual predator as well. And so I've tried to reflect that in him. But I still, maybe it's just me, but I still find him really likable too.
Yes. Well, he eventually sort of does the right thing, unlike Flashman, who really never does the right thing and is sort of happy to take advantage of every misunderstanding that goes in his favor. And there's such polar opposites. I wonder which mindset is it more challenging for you to write? Is it the sort of rogue, womanizing rogue, or the sort of blushing innocent? I mean, you really have to go.
I'll be honest. I found the blushing innocent harder to write. I'm aware whenever I'm writing anything, whether it's something fun like Mean Business, or whether it's something that I'm writing for work, you know, a chapter for a book or a journal article or something, I'm often going for a walk. And when I'm going for a walk, I'm often turning sentences over in my head. And dialogue is probably the easiest thing of all. So, you know, it's much easier to do, I guess, for fiction than for something academic. And a lot of the time I could come back from a kind of hour and a half walk with lots and lots of dialogue for Fanshawe in my head, and things that he might say. I imagine anyone seeing me kind of out and about the country lanes of Essex must think they've walked past a lunatic. I'm not necessarily doing it out loud, but my lips might be moving. So I would certainly, I'd say I found the Fanshawe dialogue easier to write. And I guess the notion of yeoman's, his innocence, not dimness, because he's not a fool, but he's just not worldly, is a harder thing to sustain. And as I think about, you know, how I might, you know, a sequel, etc., it's a hard, you know, you can't keep a guy a virgin. You know, once he's done it, he's done it. And so, yeah, there'd have to be for subsequent works, there'll have to be some kind of movement on, you know, and who and what he is. But I guess I haven't mapped all that out in my head yet.
Well, he still feels very badly about himself.
Yeah, yes, I wanted to keep that.
So you may lose the innocence, but you maintain the guilt.
Yes, well, yes, God knows I've managed, so yes.
So there's a character that we haven't talked about. You know, there's a whole cast of characters, because you've got a little team assembled that, you know, variously works on their own projects and also is in charge of training yeomen, but we haven't talked about Miss Adams yet. And most of our listeners, I think, are women. I mean, we're all of our podcast are women. And so you have this wonderful female character. Would you tell us a little bit about her?
Sure. Well, I mean, from the start, I guess no spoilers, because I wanted a certain type of character in the story. And I realized as I kind of turned it over in my mind for a few weeks and made a few notes that I sort of figuratively looked at myself in the mirror and said, "Oh, Jeremy, you're just writing a whore with a heart of gold, aren't you?" And I basically said to myself, you know, fuck it, you are. And thought, well, I'll try and take that somewhere. And that probably meant that I wanted to push the envelope both ways, because I think most kind of whores with a heart of gold are either not really whores, or they're not that golden.
Right.
And so I wanted to have her marked on the one hand by quite a significant capacity for being immoral, amoral, violent, but also to have someone who could show an astonishing degree of vulnerability given what she does for a living, you know, given that even publicly her occupation is working in a brothel, but that even privately her occupation is doing work in that line and more in the service of British intelligence, for lack of a better name. She was a character that I really came to like the more that I wrote for her, though I was left with a kind of difficulty of how one might use her in subsequent stories, for example, which I guess, you know, readers will have to read the book, available from all good vendors of ebooks, to find out where that goes. She was a character I came to like a lot, and I had, not that I ever met this woman, but I had a very distant relative of, you know, what would have been the period that we're talking about, who was called a Tryphena. They had sisters. Yeah. They're called a Tryphena and Tryphosa, which are a pair of biblical names. And I thought, well, yeah, I'll go with that. I like that name. So I did that thing with some of the names where you have, on the one hand, the kind of the long part of the name and then the sort of more plosive short part, which I think, you know, maybe it's a bit hackneyed, but it's a way of trying to make them memorable, I guess. She was a character that I liked a lot, and I liked the idea that with the character of Yeoman, he has to be brought up to speed with not being a soldier, because he's a soldier already, but being some version of a spy. And that means he has to learn to be violent in new ways. Mm-hmm. So he's got a variety of men who kind of teach him that in different ways. But that he's basically got to learn to see the world through different lenses and recognise all kinds of things about how London can be corrupt, learn things about the various ways in which men and women can interact, which he knows virtually nothing about. And so she is his tutor in that respect. And of course, you know, the immediate implication is that, you know, right, well, they're going to spend like 8 weeks in bed, and she's going to kind of bring him up to speed on everything he's missed out on in you know, the intervening dozen years or whatever. But that doesn't happen. She was a character to whom I became very, very attached.
In many ways, she's actually the most Holmesian, because her skill set is observation of trifles.
Yes.
Which is, you know, the idea that you would go and you would sit in the middle of a public square and try to determine by looking at a person what they do and who they are and where they've been and where they're going. That's the great Holmesian skill. So to have somebody whose job that is, and to find that they've sort of learned that skill by being a prostitute and really just existing amongst the lowest classes possible, but also the upper classes, right?
Yeah.
She's able to kind of travel between worlds is very interesting. Certainly there have been many attempts to make Holmes a woman, but it doesn't usually work very well. But I think she works quite well. I found myself kind of not turning pages because it's an ebook, but swiping the pages, hoping that she would turn up in the next chapter and be part of the story more. So she's very compelling. I liked her a lot.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, I mean, Holmes was certainly on my mind when I thought of those sequences where she kind of tutors him in, the science of signs around, who people are and what they might do and their professions and their leanings, etc. That was certainly a part of my thinking.
So, in your long mumbling walks, where you're coming up with Fanshawe's dialogue, did you find it easy or more difficult to write a female character?
I probably found her easier to write than Yeoman.
Really?
Which is unfortunate, I guess, given that he's arguably the narrator and the principal protagonist. I guess with him, I was always having to be thinking of the layers of meaning in what he said, that on the one hand, he's advancing the story because he tells us everything. So you have to kind of plant things in there that the reader can look at and say, well, he doesn't understand this, but from what he's told me, I understand this to be really the case. So she was more straightforward in that respect. And I guess the more I got into exploring the extent to which she was vulnerable, the more I enjoyed writing for her, the more she kind of became a fully human character to me. And I guess that's, she has more page time than some of the other characters. I mean, you made reference to the team. And I guess the other type of text that I had in mind when I was writing it was a body of films that I've written about as an academic, where teams are of experts with particular skill sets are gathered for particular purposes, and thinking of things like The Magnificent Seven, The Great Escape, Ocean's 11, etc., etc.
Yes.
And I certainly wanted to play with that idea. So yes, I've got a group of people who can all do particular things, but clearly as I wrote it, I found that I was wanting to spend more time on her than perhaps on some of the others.
Nice. So what are your, without giving any spoilers, do you have any favorite moments that you just wrote a scene and you went, oh, I just love doing this, I wish I could do this for pages and pages and pages?
There's a scene in a brothel. Don't read anything into that. But there's a scene in a brothel quite early on which kind of combines, I like to think, comedy, violence, and also just a general sense of confusion in that various things are trying to be pulled off at the same time, it could all go wrong at so many levels. And there's almost a sense of kind of Keystone Cops about it, that they're trying to get out of the building at the same time as other people are attracted by a gunshot, etc. They're trying to carry somebody's unconscious form, and you have that sort of classic scene of the guy wandering into the wrong bedroom and just encountering something for which he was utterly unprepared. I really enjoyed that's writing that sequence. The sequence that I found quite hard to write or to sustain was, there's a sequence quite late in the book where there's this enormous firefight, basically, guns, knives, everything in a country house. Mm-hmm. And I'd really looked forward to writing it because quite a lot of what I've written as an academic and the movies that I've watched and the books that I've read have been loads of things set in country houses. What's come to be called heritage film and the literature from which it derives. By the same account, I've read loads and loads of books, involving crime, violence, etc. And I quite like the idea of colliding the two, of basically having a scene where you've got a house that could be from, you know, Sense and Sensibility or whatever, but actually it becomes the scene of just the most enormous gunfight between two opposing groups of people, and, you know, all the furniture and all the walls and the curtain hangings and etc., you know, all get shot and burnt and blown to bits. And I probably found that harder to write, I guess, because I was thinking of it cinematically a lot of the time as a kind of progress through different types of rooms. And I think I kind of had to have in my mind, you know, remind myself, you know, this has to work just as words. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sold on that idea that people read books and they kind of cash it all into pictures as they read. I think, you know, for me, I think when you're reading, it's really a kind of an affair of words rather than an affair of imagining pictures. So, yeah, I had to kind of go back through that a few times, and I ended up abbreviating it significantly. So I, you know, I'm happy with the end result. I feel it works much better. But it proved harder to write than my fantasy of writing it. I sort of thought, oh, it'll just write itself. Yeah, clue, nothing writes itself. But yes, that early sequence in the brothel, I really enjoyed writing. And there's a sequence where, without trying to spoil anything, Yeoman becomes acquainted with the ways of the world. And I massively enjoyed writing that sequence.
That was hilarious. It was hilarious. It was good.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I could see how you could have a clash. So your BA is literature.
English literature, yes.
And then the MA is cinema.
Cinema, yes.
And then the PhD is novel to film.
Novel to film, yes.
So for all the listeners who are familiar with me, they'll know that Jeremy is what I want to be when I grow up. But so I could see how it would be.
Biology might present some difficulties there, but yes.
The challenge of sort of swapping between the two worlds and deciding, you know, you have to keep reminding yourself, this is a book, it's, you know, it's not a
yes.
film. But, you know, there are some cinematic elements to it. And certainly if it was a film, that last sequence with a grand firefight and the carnage and the, you know, the destruction of the beautiful home.
It would be costly. That's true. It would be costly.
Yes,
I mean, you're certainly right in that I think, you know, anyone writing now is writing, and at a certain level they're thinking about the screen, yeah, even if they deny it. You know, just like you have that fantasy of, you know, if I won the lottery, where would I live, what would I drive, and, you know, how would life be generally? I think, you know, writers probably have that version of a fantasy in which somebody says, hey, let's, it's Mr. Spielberg on the phone. vanishingly unlikely. And, they want to make a film or whatever. So, yes, you do kind of think about that. And I suppose because studying the screen has been a big part of what I do and continues to be, I'm thinking of it in that way as well. And then there's a level in which stories are just stories, and they operate across media. And certainly what I ended up writing was something that owes probably in equal measure to literary influences and film influences.
Sure, sure. Well, it would work on the screen. I do have an image in my mind of sort of a grand battle that's happening in the middle of Downton Abbey. Hmm. You know, everything's
all right, yes.
falling to bits. So that would be fun. As much as I love Downton Abbey, I'd also yes. love to see Highclere House blow up. Hmm. I think that'd be quite...
I think quite a few Marxists of my acquaintance could imagine something very similar happening in Downton Abbey. Yes.
So the very end, we have the words, the end, and Yeoman and Fanshawe will return in...
The Principality of Assassins.
And that's a very Bondian thing, always James Bond will return
at the end of the
film.
I think obviously the Bond franchise has a much better claim to the likelihood of the next instalment arriving on time. It's fair to say the sequel. No, I mean I'm not sitting here now with like an almost finished sequel sitting on my laptop. What I've got is some pretty comprehensive notes and a plot mapped out and some new characters, some old characters, and quite a few pages. But nothing imminent, I have to say.
It's got to be a challenge. I mean, you you write so much and everything for your academic career. How do you find the time at all to sort of sit down at a laptop and bang out a novel?
One of my colleagues asked me this a while ago, and my answer, which started out flippant and then became quite dangerous, was I said, well, I don't play golf, and I can't afford a mistress, which wasn't actually well received. I mean, I think the short answer is, I guess, in a way, you know, a lot of my research to publish is not, it's not archival, so I'm not having to spend hours excavating materials to find something to write about. You know, basically, I read stuff, I watch stuff, and then I think about it a bit, and then I do some writing. And my, you know, writing fiction is broadly the same. I guess with this, I had periods writing this, you know, and I wrote it over three and a bit years. I had sometimes in work where there was just so much else on, I didn't write a page for 6 months. And then I might still think about it, you know, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't actually be typing anything. The word count would not have gone up. And then I had other times where for a week I might write 3,000 or 4,000 words a day. Obviously, when you get up in the morning and you look at what you wrote the previous day, you then end up unpicking it quite a lot. But generally, yeah, I mean, I had a couple of weeks where I probably managed 12,000-15,000 words that I was actually quite happy with. I didn't have as many of those weeks in a row as I would have liked. But yeah, I mean, that was basically the way in which I wrote it. Very, very stop-start. Some weekends, some evenings, some early mornings. And sometimes over the summer, your fantasy of academic life, long empty summer, nothing to do. That's not true. It's never like that. But yeah, summer's probably a better time than anything.
Good. And and where is it available? Where can our listeners find it?
I should. I'm so useless at marketing. What should I? Well, it's available as an ebook, and you can buy it on via Amazon for your Kindle.
Great. Any intention to turn it into a paper book, or is it going to live as an ebook?
Well, it's certainly an ebook for the time being. I mean, there are all kinds of mechanisms where people will relieve you of some of your money to turn it into a book, which I wouldn't do. And so, I guess, you know, for me, the ideal would be that enough people would buy the book that I can then interest, ideally, a literary agent and then a publisher in a proper launch of the book as a material object. But increasingly, I'm sold on the idea of the ebook as the proper book.
It is. It was very nice to be able to sit and read it on trains and in tea shops and things without having to lug my library around with me. So I'm not much of a Kindle user. I haven't got a Kindle, but I actually read most of the book on my iPhone.
And, oh, excellent!
and it's a steal. So I highly recommend it. Is there anything else that you feel you need to add that you want to make sure that gets out into the world?
No, I think shameless plugs are like the last thing that I'm good at. But thank you very much indeed for the interview. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, we appreciate you talking to us.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?